Well, let us see. Are most of us back? George, Art,
yep.
Are you all here?
Yeah.
Julia? Great. All right. Tim? All right. Odette and I just spoke briefly at the break here. We have about an hour left. What we would like to try to do for sure is get through subsection 7, touch on 8 about this known bad actors, and leave some time for trying to still wrestle with question 1C. And I'll sort of divide the time up proportionate to those three subject areas. I think we'll probably spend a little bit more on the ranking thing, seeing as that seems to be something we probably have some strong input on. Does that feel comfortable to people if we try for that kind of schedule? Great. Okay. So this next question really deals with whether there should be a ranking formula, and if so, how should it be designed? And this question brings up both weighting and scoring issues. Ranking formulas have been used, as we all know, on lots of things, such as Superfund sites and others. This thing. Question here is, can we do a ranking formula? Is it helpful? What does it keep us from being able to account for, and what are the problems in it? So let's just have a general discussion on that. One thing I would suggest is people might refer to the document that was provided in the week ago's attachment 1.7, the ranking formula that was suggested, as simply an example. Anyone want to start here?
Well, this is George. I'll just, you know, start just to start the discussion, if that's okay.
That'd be great, George.
So I appreciate the need to have means of prioritizing chemicals, but at some point, I would think when you get to this chemicals of concern list, you know, I think the point is that all of those ought to be of some sort of at least potential public or environmental health concern based on a combination of an assessment of exposure potential and hazard. So I think at that point, I don't really see any sort of numerical or categorical ranking system as being particularly helpful, you know, particularly if you carry on a transparent assessment that provides the exposure information and the hazard and potency information that led you to put something on a chemicals of concern list to begin with. I don't see where trying to distill that into some sort of a ranking does anything more for you. And in fact, doing things like numerical rankings tends to become less transparent rather than more transparent in my mind.
George, just so that, let me quickly clarify, and I can see how this question isn't as clear as it could be. I guess the idea really wasn't that we have a desire to have a list that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Rather, the question was, and this, I'll be honest with you, this has been suggested by stakeholders both from, you know, industry and NGOs and academics, which is why we're putting this out here. But it's more using some sort of a ranking system or formula to decide which chemicals are going to be on that smaller list. But then once they get on the smaller list, I think I would agree there's not a need to rank those numerically.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if that's the case, then I think, you know, we've talked a lot about what we think are important factors. You know, we've talked a lot about you know, certain hazards at least being of pretty significant importance. We've talked about exposure being of importance. You know, we've talked about potency and these classification systems for potency as being another criterion by which you can rank, and I guess, you know, my feeling is that all of these things put together will serve as filters or sieves that will probably lead to a much smaller group of chemicals to deal with. And to me that's about as much as I can imagine doing with those particular factors. And then beyond that, I'd actually be much more comfortable if you just chose one factor as being more important than others, like the potential for exposure, for example, as a means of ranking, than trying to create some sort of a priori artificial numbering system.
This is Tim. I'd like to get on the queue when
you're... Yes, Tim, please go ahead. Tim and then Julia.
I thought I heard somebody.
Tim, then Julia.
Yeah, that's fine. Just getting in the queue, Tim.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I agree with what's been said about being flexible in terms of as you go from one to a larger. And I don't think that there ought to be a numeric quasi-quantitative ranking system that would list chemicals from 1 to 50, and then, you know, the idea would be you'd move through them in rank order. I think it's right to say you should end up with a subset of chemicals in products that are then addressed. So I wouldn't view a numeric ranking system as designed to get to that level of specificity. I do have to say, though, when you're asking whether you should use a ranking system with weights, whether that should be done, I think that question has to be answered in the context of as opposed to what. And when I think about the as opposed to what, my concern is actually that having a system that doesn't involve explicit judgments about how important a particular factor is and in terms of weighting, or how well or less well a particular chemical does on a variety of different factors, that absent something that's a little bit more structured like that, you have ad hoc decisions that are made or could be made. So in the best circumstances, if you had a set of qualitative factors that need to be considered by the decision maker as, you know, a la Superfund cleanups where there's 9 criteria, you know, fairly well defined, some are balancing criteria, some are, I hate to use the word, but threshold criteria that have to be met, and so on and so forth. So the idea being that gives you transparency because it's a public process. It gives kind of the flexibility that decision makers clearly need and so on and so forth. But I would think the other thing that it does is it leaves decisions actually not being made transparently, and it also can lead to the politicization of the decision making that can be shielded behind loosely worded or crafted post hoc explanations for what was prioritized and what wasn't. I don't think you ever get past that. I mean, that's in a sense human nature and the nature of the beast in general. But I do think that a ranking system with weights that again is well managed and well designed can help a lot in that. So, for example, take this point of weights. I think Julia earlier had said her concern about weights is that they are fairly, that's a subjective kind of thing. And I think that's right, but in my perspective, that's exactly why you need a weighting system there, because absent having an explicit delineation of what is the particular weight to be ascribed to one criteria versus another, it's not as if there aren't going to be subjective judgments made. It's just that those subjective judgments won't be made consistent with any well-documented and well-vetted, discussed system of weighting. So, for example, you know, I've seen some of these ranking systems where the hazard aspects of a harm aspects of a chemical tend to be weighted less than the exposure aspect, something along the lines of what George has said. And those weights were developed by having a full conversation about, from a subjective norm-based or value-based viewpoint, what should be more important in making that decision. By using that weighting along with a fairly well-defined set of categories, however you define your ranking on the value part of it, the harm part of it, you know, for want of a better term, by having something like that, it constrains some of that ad hoc nature. Now, that doesn't mean that I would say that a ranking system should straitjacket regulators, by no means. I think you have to define a system that that provides for professional judgment and flexibility within it. And also, you would not want a ranking system to kind of end up with the perception that I think a lot of folks bring to risk assessment, which is that risk assessment is not a good tool. I think most people would probably agree that risk assessment can be a very valuable tool, but the way in which it's used by some folks, the kind of opacity of the assumptions that are made in the use of it, or the view of the outcome of it as representing a single point estimate of risk that is objective and solid and without any kind of range on either side of that number, that's a problem. So with a ranking system that uses weights, one of the things that would be really important about that would be to build it into a process where there's open discussion about how various decisions were made and what assumptions were being used. But I think it does establish a fairly good framework so that people from different points of view can have there's an opportunity for a common understanding about how a decision was made, and also a platform on which sincere differences of opinion about objective issues as well as value-based issues can be discussed. Thanks.
Julia?
Yes. I guess it may be one of those things is I haven't seen enough and ranking systems, and those that I've seen I don't like. Maybe it's that thing. Maybe there is a good one around the corner and I just haven't seen it. I guess for me, when you're talking about hazards, the hazard part of this, and talking about various chemicals, the data are so uneven, or the evidence and the amount of information that you're dealing with is quite uneven. It's not, and that's where I think ranking systems to me are not as useful, because you do have to make, I have a hard time seeing without having very specific examples how you could rank or weight, a hazard if there's, really compelling and very strong evidence for one hazard trait and, suggestive evidence or not very good evidence for the other or something like that, and how you put all of that together and come out with a numerical weight. So I think because of the type of information that I know is out there or the lack thereof, I think that, and for some things, no information, I have a hard time envisioning how a ranking system is anything, less than a straitjacket, which doesn't allow enough flexibility for your expert judgment to come in. But that's, just my limited experience with it. So I think if you have a ranking system, having it vetted, as Tim mentioned, with, the experts or whoever they are, and then having very clear guidelines about the things that I'm concerned about, like how do you weight a developmental toxin against a carcinogen and those sorts of things, and one that has robust data and others that doesn't have, like endocrine disruptors where the data are developing and the database is developing and not as robust. How do you deal with all of those issues of complexity? I think if you can, profile something that takes all of those things into consideration, then it is helpful because, as you said, it's more transparent and people can see where you started and what you ended up with. But to me, I have, it's just personal. I just see it. And for the examples that were presented in the NRC document, maybe those weren't good examples. I thought they were either way too complex for the resources that we have for this process or very deficient in some way. So, maybe there are better ones out there. So my opinions on this are my lack of knowledge and then the little knowledge that I have with the systems that I reviewed and didn't think would be useful for this. That's the qualification.
Candid, is Dr. Megan in the queue, please?
Art, please.
This is Art Fong. Just want to follow up on what Julia was saying. In terms of, just practical experience from how we evaluate and rank chemicals that have potential adverse impact on human health and the environment here. Is that, again, given the fact that, you know, there are there's just not enough information on many of the endpoints or of concern, that when we try to do numerical ranking, it tends to be somewhat artificial. So instead of, you know, doing one of these artificial numerical ranking, what we found, you know, to be more helpful is a, you know, qualitative professional judgment by people with expertise on that particular factor, it has a factor or exposure factor, and that seems to be more useful in terms of helping us make decisions about what chemicals to use in terms of process and manufacturing, or in IT products. So I think, you know, ranking is, it seems to be a necessity in terms of determining what chemicals finally get into the category of chemicals of the highest concern for regulatory purposes. But at the same time, our practical experience is that numerical ranking tends to be somewhat arbitrary and artificial, again, due to the fact that there's just usually not enough information out there, and that, you know, qualitative professional judgment by people with expertise in the area seems to be more helpful in terms of helping us guide making selection of chemicals to use. Thank you.
Well, this is Ken, and I'll just pile on in this case by saying that my experience with numeric formulas for ranking has also been disappointing. In the work that we've done, for instance, in trying to identify chemicals of high concern in Massachusetts, or in just keeping chemicals on and off the list, we've used an expert judgment process. But it is not, I mean, the first part of it is that it's a very open and transparent process, which is really important, so people who are not part of the process can see how a decision is being made. The second part of it is we do try to display things and sometimes use scoring, and even we'll use indicators of weights for how people think they're weighting when they're trying to make a decision. But the highly reductionist nature of a formula that actually has a mathematical calculation to it, I find very much of a straitjacket, and very much something that just gets into large amounts of contention, and that does not serve well to help make a wise and thoughtful decision. So I guess I would say I can see value in using scores and even presenting evidence of how people are, how the department is going to weight decisions as a way to help structure a decision, but I would recommend against the actual use of calculations or any kind of formula effort.
Okay, just so that I would appreciate hearing from other members of the group on what Ken has just talked about in terms of using some type of a scoring and weighting system that doesn't necessarily include a formula ranking.
This is Tim. I'd like to get on the queue.
Okay, let me just check here. Odette, were you asking some of the other staff? Is that?
No, some of the other members of the subcommittee.
Oh, of the subcommittee. Okay, Tim, please.
So let me just clarify, and Odette, this will, I think, go to your question. I was thinking the same thing. Let me just clarify, when I talk about having a system that takes into account weight and scoring, I'm not necessarily talking about a system where everything would be converted to math and multiplication and hidden inside algorithms. I think there is a role for things like that in different perspectives, but you know, there's many different ways of attempting to use a ranking system. One in particular that I think is, you know, an adaptation of this notion of control banding, where the notion is you're trying to, if you're not trying to come up with a quantitatively derived list, you know, of 1 through 10 that are indicating preferences for one chemical over another, but rather trying to get a sense of which ones should be addressed first and which ones can wait, something like a control banding approach that places chemicals into bins, right? So it's not so much that you're going to be adding up particular scores, but rather you will develop scores that are going to give you a range. It's basically converting a qualitative notion such as a high level of concern versus a low level of concern into a numeric format, and then thinking also about other factors and then using the conjunction of those factors to identify what kind of bin you're put in. And this notion of control banding, which is being looked at for prioritization both at a government level but also within businesses in terms of what types of chemical nanomaterials you should be worried about, I think offers a way of getting some of the benefits of a ranking, a formal ranking system, while still retaining the sense of expert judgment that's important. The other thing I would say is, you know, I guess Ken's point raises this question, which is, if you're not using a ranking system, exactly how are you going to perform it? And the perspective I guess I bring from this is, you know, I assume everybody, you know, in a regulatory system, I assume that the folks who are implementing that system are doing the very best that they can. But even they are subject to both resource constraints and then constraints from a political constraints that are imposed upon them because of the circumstances. And I think that you really do need a system that doesn't allow political decisions or interest-based to be undertaken under the veil of the flexibility and use of professional judgment. And the way to do that, I think, is to establish some very, very clear, articulable standards and to show how those standards interact.
So this is George. You know, just maybe this is what you're talking about in terms of control banding, Tim, is, you know, very similar to the discussion that we had about the bins of potency for GHS. And, you know, I would think that you know, the one very transparent way of going about things is one might have under hazard certain hazards that for various reasons you would want to prioritize first. And, you know, we've talked about whether CMRs are the right thing or CMRs plus a couple of other hazard traits are the right things. And that would be a first sieve in a process. You know, the second sieve might be which are highly potent, the based on, say, GHS classification. A third sieve might be the potential for exposure, and that might be, you know, number of products that contain those things, concentration in product, production volume, or even presence in the environment that's measured. And again, those things can be quantitated beforehand and provide that kind of transparency and objectivity. And my feeling is that applying that large number of sieves or control banding, as Tim puts it, if I'm understanding that term the right way, will provide you with a finite number of chemicals in the end that you would want to go after. And I don't know whether that is sufficient to get you down to the number that you are looking for, but if it isn't, you know, then at least you have criteria that you've decided on are important that you can either make more strict or relax based on you know, what you have learned from the prioritization exercise. But even if you do that, you still got these objective, transparent criteria by which you are restricting or relaxing your prioritization scheme.
Okay. I think we've basically generally said roughly the same thing on this question of ranking. I think most of us have said, you know, there's room for thinking about this, but avoiding a calculus reduces it. And I think you've heard some variations on that theme, and certainly some interest in looking at control banding as well as a vehicle for this. I'd like to move to the bad actors question. This, I know I've heard this over a year, that certain chemicals are such obvious candidates for state attention that perhaps you want to just move them to the front of the line, and others worry that this may be hard to do, seeing as it gets tied up in chemicals of a lot of popular concern. Are there thoughts, or can we be helpful to the department in thinking about this question? Odette, do you have anything you want to add to that makes this salient to you? Odette, can you speak up?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just going to echo what you said, Ken. This concept has been tossed around by a number of people over the past year, and there are a number of people who want us to quickly identify known bad actors, I'm using parens, and move those quickly through the process. But what we'd like to know is it a good idea to take that approach? If you think it is, how do we go about identifying and providing a rationale for what we are identifying as known bad actors?
Or, this is Jeff, or be even more explicit, instead of using those code terms, tell us exactly what you think are those known bad actors.
Name names.
This is Julia. And I think there are chemicals that, you know, should be looked at because they've been the subject of regulatory attention for environmental, for reasons of MA toxicity in some cases, and because, they are of concern environmentally. I would start with, you know, chlorinated hydrocarbon solvents. You know, a number of them have been banned in consumer products like cars for reasons of hazard, you know, toxicity. And I'm talking about the perchloroethylene, trichloroethylene, and methylene chloride, all carcinogens, you know, and dry cleaning being banned in some future date. But we know that, you know, in a certain set of consumer products, those chemicals have been targeted. So if those chemicals are in consumer products that are of interest to us, you know, vulnerable populations may be, sensitive subpopulations may be exposed or something like that, it makes sense to go after those because they have been a target and they are on a lot of lists. A set of chemicals that are not as well characterized are the brominated flame retardants. We have a lot of data. I think there's a growing database that would indicate that Californians are at may have higher exposures, and that those data are being collected by different programs. And there are regulations, there are reasons why we have higher, disproportionately exposed. So that could be a list. People have talked a lot about the phthalates and things like that, where, you know, they're popping up in various biomonitoring again could allow for some of that focus. But I do think, depending on how you name the categories, that there are things that lead, of course, would rise right to the top, because we have whole programs dedicated to, reducing lead exposures or finding where those exposures are. So in that sense, I think, and because actions are already being taken, and more to the point, alternatives have been developed, I think that it would be not as burdensome to some of the regulated community, and I'm not one of those not in their community, so I shouldn't even say that. But at least, you know, for those things for which we have developed alternatives, because they have, for some reason, been identified as bad actors or there is a sufficient database to indicate that, then I think it makes sense to me that those would be, you know, targeted somewhere at the top.
This is Jeff again. So
yes.
Thank you, Julia, because you're went right to the point. I mean, I see known bad actors as equivalent to the use of the word they, and I always want to know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the other issue is that looking at the three words, known bad actor. So known, meaning we have evidence, bad, that they do something bad. In a few of your examples, you have brought out that not everything is known. So one of your examples is that it should be focused on because we need more information. And then you brought up the other issue of that there are known alternatives. So I'm not criticizing you for bringing those factors in, but it goes to the point why use of the code term known bad actors is not helpful to the agency.
Right.
Because there is so much unclarity and meaning associated with that blur of three words.
Right.
So again, I remind the committee that we want some explicit guidance.
So this is George. You know, my concern about known bad actors, you know, you might have just voiced it, Jeff, but, you know, we've just spent a couple of hours talking about, you know, really explicit, objective, transparent criteria by which we might prioritize something, and I'd hate to throw that out the window, you know, because I happen to know, or you happen to know, or somebody else happens to know that these chemicals are bad. There are lists of chemicals out there that have already gone through rigorous regulatory processes, and if we want to define those as the known bad actors, so things that are on Europe's CMR Category 1A list, for example, you know, I don't think that there would be much objection because we know the process by which they've gotten on that list. Same for EPA's PBT list, for example. Those are the kinds of things that I think that we can all agree have gone through a process. But beyond that, I worry about this known bad actor characterization because the term really doesn't have any scientific definition, and I worry that it will be licensed to go beyond these really objective and transparent criteria that we've talked about, and Tim's fear of us having things listed for the wrong reasons will come to fruition.
Well, I'll jump in here as well just to say that I kind of where George is on this, I think, and that is there are certain lists that have been vetted in the regulatory arena so heavily and so well that, you know, I'm just hoping that we don't have to spend a long time, we don't set up a process in California that spent a long time trying to get to things which we well recognize scientifically and all are, quote, known bad actors. I don't think I want to use that phrase and all, but I think moving effectively and relatively quickly to things that we really do know are well characterized. And I agree that with Julia that for which we know there are many alternatives available. It just doesn't. We shouldn't be stalling California's movement. We should be enhancing its movement here. So I would say I would agree. I don't think beyond certain lists, we probably wouldn't reach consensus amongst any group of people, but I think there are some that we could do that.
This is Tim. I'd like to get on the queue when you have a
Tim, question. Yes, please.
I just want to echo my support for that notion. I'm sorry, Jeff, I'm not in a position to identify specific chemicals, but I do agree with the notion that the right folks should be able to do that in an open way, and that I agree with everything that's been said about there's some obvious situations where much good could be done while the longer process of identifying some other chemicals that aren't so well defined would be going on.
Ken, this is Art. May I get in the queue, please?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Art.
This is Art Fong, and I think, you know, what Ken and Tim and George said makes a lot of sense in terms of certain compounds that have in fact gone through a very extensive evaluation, open evaluation process in terms of resource considerations. You know, there's no point in, going through this whole evaluation process. But at the same time, you know, these certain, let's say, highly agreed upon known actors, if they are in fact, you know, in that category, isn't it likely that they are already regulated by other types of statutes and regulations? So another way of looking at this is, oh, yeah, these are obvious, but they are so obvious that they're probably already regulated. So we need to make sure that, in fact, how they're regulated is not going to be the current safer consumer product alternatives regulation framework. So not going to do something that's going to be redundant. Thank you.
I think it's a good point, Art, but I think very quickly all you'd have to do is look at the chlorinated solvents that Julia mentioned or the Category 1 carcinogens and realizing products. They're not well regulated yet.
Yes.
Who was going to jump in?
This is Colleen Heck with the department. I was just going to echo what you were pointing out, Ken, that the statute says that DTSC should not get involved with the chemical in a particular consumer product if there's some other existing regulatory scheme that is essentially of the same scope as our program, which I think is not very often going to be the case, that the other regulatory scheme covers the chemical in the product from all the way from raw materials, mining, if you will, to end of life. So that's the only prohibition. A lot of the chemicals we're talking about are regulated by one state or federal agency or another, but certainly very few of those are regulated throughout the entire life cycle.
Good point, yeah. All right, so this is a gap. Yeah. Yes, please.
Not going on this too much and using a different term of art, which we can talk about, but essentially those that are commonly and well known to be serious problems and for which alternative development is already underway. When you come back in May, think about some more examples that you would like to offer up to the panel as a whole to provide suggestions to the department on.
I think there was just an important add-on to what you said, Odette, which I think I heard almost unanimous discussion of the concepts that have been well studied by reputable bodies in an open and transparent process.
Yes, yeah.
And for which there are reasonable alternatives available.
Right.
I think that's the other piece. But I think that in the cases of the chemicals we just mentioned, and certainly I can say this for the chlorinated solvents, that's very true.
And so
okay.
Steph was writing me a note when you're thinking about this, you know, because you talked about these being on other lists. They'll be thinking about in May coming back and identifying which lists you would recommend we look at as sources. Thank you.
Are you suggesting we should try to hit that question right at the moment?
No, that's your homework.
That's a homework until May. That's what I thought you were saying. Okay. So charge to our little subcommittee is, can we be a little more descriptive about what lists we're talking about here?
I think that would be helpful for the discussion with the whole group in May.
Great. Good. Well, we have a little bit of time here, a few minutes left. Could we move to, once again, take a look at the last question that the department posed? And this has to do with kind of staging. That is, should there be a limit to specified chemicals or chemical categories during implementation years? That is, should we in some way figure out a way to
start in a reduced kind of pilot or early phase.
Come on, Julia.
Okay. Julia. Julia.
I was thinking that we have actually, I thought, dealt with this maybe coming from a different angle, and maybe this is a different question. So we talked about a larger list that wouldn't be subjected necessarily to prioritization of any kind, like either by thresholds or however, potency or whatever. And then the prioritization process would take into consideration the thresholds and some of the exposure potential and all the other things that we talked about. And I think at the last, you posed a question to the group, Ken, about, you know, what are we, you know, trying to get our input on whether or not we're talking about 3,000 chemicals, you know, 50 chemicals or 20 chemicals or that sort of thing. And I thought that there was fair agreement amongst this group anyway to be decided in May that we are talking about a, you know, a much narrow, you know, a somewhat narrowed list, no, not 50 or something like that, or I don't know, somewhere in that category. I just think it has to be manageable, and there's an awful lot to do here, and I don't think it's practical to, I don't think it's wise not to have that larger list, but I think it's imperative almost to prioritize that larger list down based on criteria to something that is manageable. Otherwise, nothing will happen, in my opinion. It's just an awful lot of work with limited resources. So, I don't know, am I correct in thinking that we have dealt with this maybe, in, or you're asking for more here?
Well, let me, just so that, let me clarify the question. This question came about because you will probably recall in the prior versions of the regulations, it's that I think with respect to chemicals, it said that the first time around we would only look at, I think, DMRs and maybe some PBTs. And then a subsequent list would open up and look at a broader scope. So the question here is, does anybody see any value in writing into the regulations something that says for the first list or first X number of years, we limit our focus to certain categories of chemicals, and just identify some ways you could do that if you thought there was value in that.
So this is George.
Yes,
and,
go ahead, George.
And you know, this is one of those things that you're going to have to help us out, I think. But you know, if you're resource limited and you want to hit the ground running, I think that it would really behoove you to take somebody else's list. And we talked about things like CMR Category 1 and run with it, because if you have to develop your own system de novo, go through all of the screening, strength and weight of evidence that we've talked about, that will set you back many months, if not years, in coming to that early list. It's not to say that it shouldn't be done, but you know, I think that you know, as a means of starting quickly, there is good sense to look at something that has been, or to adopt a list that has been evaluated by an authoritative body that used objective scientific criteria to establish a list.
Other comments here?
Karen, this is Art. May I get into queue, please?
Yes, Art, go ahead.
Yeah, I think George, what George says makes a lot of sense. And in terms of, you know, kind of responding along the lines of Dr. Wong's suggestion about being more specific and getting away from code words. And so what I think, you know, makes a lot of sense is that one way to approach this is to follow the REACH, you know, criteria for the classifying substances of very high concern, and you know, this is I'll mention this, but everybody on the call knows what those criteria are. So starting with, you know, carcinogenic, mutagenic, and toxic to reproduction, you know, categories 1 and 2, and then persistent, bioaccumulative and toxic, or very persistent and very bioaccumulative, and then on a case-by-case basis, identify from scientific evidence, you know, other substances that causes a high probability of serious effects to humans and or the environment. So that to me seems like the logical place to start. And in terms of writing it specifically into the regulation itself, it just seems like that makes a lot of sense in terms of where to start, and also what George said about resources and time frame in terms of actually getting something manageable in place. Thank you.
This is Tim. I'd like to get on the queue when you have a chance.
Tim, go ahead.
Thank you, Tim Malloy. I agree with what's been said about the idea of getting a jump start on things. I'd actually been thinking about it in terms of kind of like the prioritization, kind of in the interim or short term and then long term. So either by incorporating a more truncated procedure in the way that Art suggested, or perhaps even identifying particular chemicals of concern in the regulation themselves as part of that process would be a way of jump-starting it. And I think there's two important considerations if you were to go in that direction. One is, to the extent possible with resource constraints, I think it would be useful to take the short-term, early prioritized chemicals and start moving them through the rest of the process, the product prioritization, and then into the alternatives analysis, so that you're developing and learning, you're using those to develop and learn how to actually do all the rest of this regulatory process, while at the same time continuing to develop the procedures and the actual lists of the other chemicals of concern. Because my concern is if you start with a short-term list, that you'll never, there's kind of an inertia, and we've seen it in other regulatory programs where an agency's told to list things, and it takes a very, very long time to list them, so, and then they're given a list of materials, and then what happens is those list of materials become the de facto program in its entirety, and nothing else ever gets listed. So, to the extent that it can be done in tandem, resource-wise, I think it would be a good idea, a good idea to do that. So that, and the other part I just wanted to emphasize was that I think this whole process, this program in the long term, is going to be an iterative learning process. So the sooner you can start seeing how the alternatives assessment and regulatory response process is going to work, the better. Thank you.
Julia, are you anything?
Tim, did you say actually to put in specific chemicals of concern into the regulation as the part of the, you know, pilot or, you know, the interim of whatever we're using here in terms of the first phase?
Yeah.
Okay. I think the only thing that worries me a little bit about that, instead of the general categories of CMRs and PBTs, is that we don't have a good handle on the product in. And I'm just worried that there may be products for which some of these groups of chemicals or the those classifications may be in that are of real concern, and we may not get the right chemicals in there to start with. So, you know, because we've all talked about the whole sort of tandem process of chemicals and products, because unlike a lot of REACH and a lot of things, we're focused on consumer products and consumer products for which the COCs have high potential exposure and the sensitive subpopulations, and, you know, all the rest of the prioritization stuff. So I just worry a little bit about being that specific, unless the DTSC kind of, you know, they've been looking at products and they could pick the right chemicals so that it would work smoothly. That's all. I'm just expressing a little concern.
This is Tim. Could I get on the
screen? Yes, please.
I think that's an excellent point, and I worry about that as well. But the way I think about it is it's always kind of a choice between, well, what would be the alternative, you know, scenario that would occur.
Yeah.
And so I think to myself, you know, so you might end up putting one on that it turns out later when all the data comes in, there's another one that you're more concerned with.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I think about it is the first couple are going to be the first couple of chemicals through is really a learning process for how alternatives assessment will work and how regulatory response should work. And by getting started on a couple, even if it turns out that maybe they weren't actually worse, I don't know that you're that worse off, because if you didn't do that, you would be delayed in addressing those other chemicals of higher concern anyhow, because they would be caught up in the longer process of, you know, doing all the identification and prioritization. So it's not clear to me, assuming that the resource constraints aren't functioning here, right, that the idea of moving a couple through down the chain there of alternative assessment and regulatory response somehow slows down the prioritization process. There I would be concerned about, but if it could be done in a way that getting a couple or a few through, kind of like case study, you know, early action one through, you get a lot of experience, I think, which would then, once you've kind of identified your, through the longer, the more involved process, and the, you've identified those that are perhaps of more concern, you'll have already the experience and in place a working mechanism for alternative assessment and regulatory response that I think ultimately you might discover that you get more expeditious action on those others, even though you put a couple ahead of them in the queue.
Mr. Odette, let me toss out quickly an idea for you guys to respond to hearing what you said. I mean, one possibility is that we do list in the regs, we need your help doing this, small group of specific chemicals that we start the product prioritization and AA process with right away. And then, you know, we have this in one of the prior versions of the regs, there could be some sort of deadline for the department to come out with the next list of chemicals.
Yeah, for me that would make sense. That that is because there's another factor which others here on the committee haven't mentioned, and that is the need to move to make this project, this program concrete and real. I mean, we've already delayed the regulations. This has been now in process for nearly 2 years. You know, I think we don't want this to just drag on. So my urgent feeling is that we would identify a specific small set of chemicals and move both for the learning but also for making it concrete, such that the legislature and the state of California understands that this is actually moving forward. Others comment on this?
I agree with your point very strongly, Ken.
Yeah, I agree as well. I just want to make sure that we don't get accused of picking on somebody's favorite chemical.
Well, that is a danger.
Because that's the sort of pushback you may get with this, is that unless the criteria are consistent with the statute and well-defined and transparent, it's going to look like you just arbitrarily and capriciously went after some chemicals.
I'm happy letting IR take the hit for picking on a few chemicals. Any other comments here? We're closing down toward the end. Any general comments, things that got left out?
Ken, this is our may I make a general comment, please?
Yeah, please.
This goes back to having two list for, you know, of chemicals, and I think it was mentioned either by one of the somebody from the public or one of the Green Ribbon Science Panel members, using the first list, one of the functions as, you know, being a market driver to greener designs, and then you know, I don't think that's a good enough reason to have two lists. And again, I'm not against actually having two lists. I'm just thinking that, in fact, if that's what we're going to do, or if that's what DTSC does, I think it's very important for the stakeholders and for stakeholders that will be affected by this particular regulation that DTSC very clearly state the reason for having the two separate lists and what are the, and the advantages of having the two separate lists. Because I think George or somebody else mentioned that there are consequences to putting something on a list, even though you might look at it as just a parking lot or as an alert to industry. But there are consequences. So I think if that's the direction DTSC is going to go, I think it's very important that it clearly states what the reason for having the two separate lists are, and then the advantages of going with this approach. Ken, thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
We're required to do something called a statement of reasons, so it will be explained.
Other comments? Other summary comments? Odette, would you like to close with a comment here?
Well, I just want to thank all of you for your time and your thoughtfulness. I think, you know, today you all have contributed some very specific suggestions and reflections on the ideas, and so I think that we saw a pretty good feel, and that the next step, as I think we talked about last time, will be we're going to work with the co-chair to summarize what we've heard, send it out as a draft to members of the committee to make sure that you concur that we've captured your thoughts correctly. We're not going to name names in there, but we want each of you to look at it to be sure that you feel that your thoughts are accurately reflected. So we'll send that out as a draft for you to comment on, and then that will be finalized, posted, and will be up for review by the whole committee in May. So, is there anything else you want to add, Ken?
No, I just want to thank people for really, at this point, 5 hours of heavy engagement. This was an experiment on our part, and we certainly, as a committee, have lived up to the expectations, and I certainly thank you and congratulate all of us for this hard work. So thank you.
Thank you.